Before November 8, many national pollsters said we'd be talking about President-elect Hillary Clinton at this point. Then the voters said, no, let's be talking about President-elect Donald Trump. So I've asked Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll, to talk about his pre-election numbers and any oopses. And Charles, and we've given you like 3 weeks and 1 day to reflect. And thanks very much for coming in.
Sure.
Okay, well, your last poll for Marquette, mm-hmm. let's just go over two different scenarios, said Mr. Trump 40% and Secretary Clinton 46%. And the voters said in Wisconsin, 48% Wisconsin voters for Mr. Trump, 47% for Secretary Clinton. And then the U.S. Senate race, your last poll, you had former Senator Democrat Russ Feingold at 45% and incumbent U.S. Senator Republican Ron Johnson at 44%. The voters said 47% for Mr. Feingold, 50% for Mr. Johnson. Where do pollsters go to say, oops, or I'm sorry?
Well, we come on shows like this either the day after or 3 weeks later and go, nope, we're still wrong. Well, we're still wrong.
But your record had been pretty damn good.
Well, I think first of all, this shows that anybody can be wrong. I've said that from the beginning.
I think you ended your last press conference with Mike Gushee saying any poll can be wrong.
Sure.
I think my notes reflected that.
Excuse me. Well, thank you. I'm glad that I got that on the record ahead of time. But seriously, there are two things that are going on, and they're a little bit different. In the presidential race, not a single poll in the state by anybody had Trump ahead over the last year since January. Not one. And so there you have a truly shocking result that the average across the polls was a 5-point Clinton lead. Our last poll was a 6-point lead. And Trump's leading as of today's count by 0.75 percentage point. So that's a big error. And we didn't see it coming, in the sense that the average of the polls and my own poll didn't show movement towards Trump in the last 2 or 3 weeks of the campaign. The Senate side is a little different.
You had it by the margin of error. Excuse me.
Yes, we did. We had just a 1-point Feingold lead in our last poll, but we also showed a trend from a 5-point Feingold lead to a 2-point to a 1-point, and we captured Senator Johnson's improving favorability numbers, his improvement in name recognition, and his improvement in cares about people like you, so that at the end, what had been a Feingold advantage on all of those traits was really a dead heat on the traits as well as on the vote. Now, we still missed the outcome that was a 3-point Johnson win instead of a 1-point Feingold win, but we saw the trend and we explained what was going on. And so the poll was capturing that movement. But the exact same respondents in the same polls didn't see any movement towards Trump. And so this is the puzzle that I and all the other pollsters are working on, because we saw a similar kind of pattern in Michigan and Pennsylvania, the two critical states that were such surprises. So late decisions is an obvious answer.
I saw one poll, late deciders in Wisconsin, 58% for Trump?
Yes. That's people who decided in the last week, which
would
be
after your window of your last poll.
Yeah, we finished polling 8 days before the election, which is our normal thing. That'll obviously be one of the things to look at, is whether we would have captured movement if we had interviewed through the final week. There's only one poll that did that, the internet poll by SurveyMonkey, and we haven't seen the details of that, though they seem to have shown a closer race at the end. They had Johnson ahead by one in their final poll. So that'll be something to look at. The exit polls showed this 58-30 advantage for Trump on late deciders. The other thing they showed, and that would shift the vote by 4.1 percentage points in Trump's direction just from that alone.
Have exit polls traditionally been accurate, Charles?
Well, exit polls are adjusted to match the outcome of the race after the fact.
After the fact.
And that's a statistically respectable procedure to do that adjustment, but it is complicated and it's subject to some debate. The biggest debate about exit polls is whether they reflect the groups and how they voted accurately or not. They're certainly accurate on the overall vote because they're weighted to that result. But whether they capture all the groups with real fidelity is another question. The good news is in about 6 or 8 months, we'll get data from the Census Bureau about which demographic groups turned out. And we can then match that up against the exit polls, but it's this slow, agonizing process of months before the census releases those data.
A few days after the election, several national pollsters, you were not among them, gathered in Denver. And here's what a Trump advisor named Wayne Allen Root told that group of pollsters at a breakout session. Quote, "No matter how bad the polls look, they are meaningless because the anger and volatility of this electorate does not show up in the polls." Last sentence, "My people are not telling the pollster they're for Donald Trump." Was that true in Wisconsin?
It's not clear. There are two kinds of Trump hidden voters. There's what's called the shy voter, which he seems to be describing, who when they're interviewed won't tell a person that they're voting for Trump. Okay? Those shy voters, the profession, other pollsters, did a lot of research on over the last year and pretty strongly showed that while there was a hesitation to tell a live person you were voting for Trump mm-hmm. before the primary started, that disappeared during the primaries in the summer. And when the same test was applied in October this year, we didn't see any difference between telling a human interviewer and telling a machine a robocall.
That's important.
It's
now,
very
was that,
important.
Was that after the primaries and after Mr. Trump got the GOP nomination?
Yes.
They were more willing to say, "I'm a Trump supporter."
That's right. And during the primaries, a different piece of evidence is that the primary polls weren't systematically wrong on Trump's vote. They didn't underestimate his vote, which hidden Trump voters would predict. So we have at least two different sources of information, an experiment where half the people answer a live interviewer and half answer on a machine. That's the test of the shyness of who are you talking to. But then we also have the empirical fact that across all those primaries, there were some errors, but there wasn't on average any systematic tendency to underestimate Trump's vote. So that takes care of one side of the argument pretty well, and it was certainly intensely studied before the election. The much harder one, though, would be if there are Trump voters who are absolutely going to vote and absolutely won't talk to any pollster ever. Because how do you learn something about people that won't talk to you?
Right.
And that's
very challenging.
Are
these people that just thank you, no, and hang up? Or are they out there attempting to deceive your pollster?
I think there's very little evidence of systematic deception.
Thank you.
We ask over the course of a survey something on the order of 70 questions total. That's an awful lot of questions to consistently misrepresent your position. It's just tiring if you actually try to do it. So lie on one single question, yeah, that's possible. But then your answer to that question would be out of line to your answers on all the other questions. Are you really going to sit there and consistently tell me that you think Trump's not qualified and you think Clinton is qualified when in fact you think the opposite? It's just very hard to do. I'm not saying it couldn't happen with a few individuals, but out of, in our final poll, 1,400 people.
Let's stop
it's
there.
It's a small effect.
The wonk in me, you know how closely I follow your polls. You normally survey 800 to 900. You went up to 1,400 trying to catch any last minute. You even had a wider sample.
Yeah.
Last poll?
Well, we've actually been doing that for a while, raising the sample size in the last one or usually the last two polls before the election, simply to narrow the margin of error and to have a bigger sample size so we can look at subgroups with more fidelity as well. So we did 1,000 in our next to the last poll and 1,400 in our final
right.
for exactly that reason. We did that during the 14 governors and in right. the, at the end of 2012 as well. So we do have that as our standard practice. But the purpose of it is not changing the criteria for being included in the survey. It's simply we dial more numbers, we pay for more completed interviews that way. Here's the deal, though. We have plenty of Trump voters in our sample. Why would we then be missing the 7% Sweet. That his vote did better than what our last poll said?
Yes.
That's what we're searching for now, looking to see where we know that on some things, like media markets around the state, we were representing all those media markets in proportion to their actual number of registered voters. But did turnout shift in some of them? That's one thing we'll look at. Is it possible that maybe we underrepresented certain groups in that mix? And the biggest thing still looks like a change in vote. If you look at all the groups we interviewed compared to the exit poll, we are very close to the Clinton vote on almost every one of them, but Trump is systematically 7 or 8 points better in all those groups. So what is it that boosts him that way? Late deciders, we've already mentioned, and conflicted voters who had negative views of both candidates. In the exit poll, that was 22% of the electorate, and they went 60-22 for Trump.
For Mr. Trump.
And so it's not hard to believe that that represented a fair number of voters who were conflicted. Maybe the FBI letter played a role, but maybe those conflicted voters were more Republican-leaning and in the end broke for Trump.
You mentioned the FBI letter. This was such an unusual cycle. Twice when you're in the field with your pollsters, you had major news. Now, you chose, to your credit, to say these were the results Thursday, Friday, these were the results Saturday and Sunday. But here's my question. In light of these major news developments, do you sure. wish you would have stopped polling, given voters a chance to absorb the news, and then, I know it's costly, restart the whole process?
Yeah. It's not so much the cost alone, it's just the impracticality of doing that, because you're left with a partial sample if you stop.
Did you give some thought to doing it?
No, because in fact the advantage is you can make the before and after comparison. It's actually a plus that way. In hindsight, we could have done another survey later in the week, or we could just adjust our overall schedule to do polling later in the week. Though that doesn't guarantee there won't be a news event that happens in the middle of the next poll.
Absolutely, because there's no way, a major news event every 24 hours.
Exactly, and there's no way to avoid that. You just live with it as a pollster. What we did see was a bit of a shift from Clinton before the FBI letter towards Trump afterwards. We saw independents shift from being pro-Clinton to pro-Trump by a moderate margin.
Was this the second Comey statement?
This was the letter that he released on Friday. Then there was a final letter that was released the weekend before the election. We're talking about the first letter, not that final statement.
Okay.
But here's the thing. 3 weeks earlier, the Trump video had come out in the same circumstances, splitting our survey. We saw enormous shifts between before and after. And 3 weeks later, it all evaporated.
Mm-hmm.
So you're left wondering, a more modest shift that we saw with the Comey letter, was that going to evaporate over this last week or not? There's no way to know. And so we presented the results as we had them, but I went ahead and would do it again, combine all 1,400 interviews over the full weekend and let the balance between the before and after letter sort of average out together, and that's how we get to our final
And you had
result.
No way of knowing that the Democratic turnout in Dane County would be off, I think, 15%, and in Milwaukee and either Racine or Kenosha off 20%. You had no way of knowing that.
Well, no, or let me put it differently. We had a way, and it said that wasn't happening. What we saw in our data in that last poll, and I mentioned it, but only in passing at the final event, because we weren't focused on turnout, we showed a 4% decline in turnout compared to 2012.
Yeah.
The actual looks like it's about a 3.5% or so decline, talking about the total votes cast in 16 compared to 12. So we saw that decline in turnout, and we actually were pretty close to it. But Democrats and Republicans in that final poll were equally likely to drop off. And so since there was no partisan difference in reported certainty of voting, it didn't provide any evidence that this would be an imbalance. Now, again, in retrospect, the numbers you cite is a perfect example of, it looks like by Election Day, there was an asymmetry in that vote. And again, maybe that asymmetry would have started to show up if you had polled through the weekend before the election. You know, a lot of hindsight there.
Well, knowing how you're Wisconsin's perhaps premier pollster, I mean, you're hired by national TV to help them make the calls. What is your profession going to do differently going forward?
Well, there's going to be a long, deep dive into this. There's going to be a national report on the polls in May at the National Conference of Pollsters. I am on the committee to do that evaluation, but I'm on the part to do the primaries. I'm not involved with the examination of the November polls. And that will be sort of a profession-wide look at what happened. Things are complicated this time because certainly the polling led us all, including me, to expect that Clinton would eke out a victory of some margin. The popular vote is eking out that victory.
2 million.
But it's Clinton's Donald Trump who's going to the White House. So
yes, because of the Electoral College. Well, what's your personal reaction as a professional pollster when you're wrong like that?
Well, you know, you're not very happy about it. One of the things is you go back and you say, well, now knowing this, looking at our data, would we have come to a different conclusion? I haven't had the time to dig deeply enough into it because I've been busy talking to people like you. Yeah. But we will do that deep dive. The first cut so far doesn't seem to suggest anything that I would change, for example, other than clearly poll later in the week and see if that would have made a difference, but I don't have the option of doing that now.
Yeah.
I think the question is it sufficient to say that late deciders made the difference? But if we look at the 6% who told us they were undecided, even if we allocate them by party to a candidate, we would only shift the 6-point Clinton lead to a 5-point Clinton lead.
You would only shave it by one percentage point.
It would not, and I actually did look at that ahead of time, it would not be enough to make a difference in who we would have said is ahead. Okay. Now, on the one hand, you can say, aha, that's further evidence of a failed poll. But on the other hand, it says to me, there's not something lurking in that data that we could have done differently. The other is turnout. I already mentioned Dems and reps were equally likely to turn out. But if we had used the full registered voter sample instead of the likely voter sample, again, it wouldn't have changed the results by more than one percentage point. So there's a lot to follow up on here, and we may yet find something that if I'd had the gumption to look at, we would have caught. But so far, it looks more like that late deciders and breaking people who were conflicted.
One final question on the subject before we turn to something else. Those that immediately say, this is the death of modern polling. Yeah. Give me a quick response to that.
I think it's far more complicated than that. Here in Michigan and in Pennsylvania, we were all, the average of the polls in each of those states, were well off. That's very worrisome. But in the other battleground states of Ohio and Florida and North Carolina, all of those were actually quite accurate. And on the national side, again, in terms of the popular vote, which is the national polls, they weren't bad. So it's a more complicated story. But given the fundamental result that the surprise was Donald Trump winning the presidency,
right.
I don't think, you know, that's sort of cold comfort, except at the technical level that this seems to have affected three big industrial states that hadn't voted Republican since the 80s. And then in the competitive states, the polling was pretty accurate.
And just a final note, the pressure on you to get it right continues as we look at 2018, U.S. Senate, governor, control of the legislature. Okay, I'm also glad that you came in today because I asked you to take a look at some of the four major changes in Wisconsin politics over the last, you've had the Marquette poll 4 years?
Yes.
2012, 2016.
Yep.
So thank you for the list. We're going to put up a graphic now. The first one, how voters identified with parties in the 2016 election. Give me a couple minutes on that.
Normally, there's a Democratic advantage in the overall population of the state, something in the 4% or maybe 5% range. In recent presidential exit polls, that's been consistently 5 or 6% Democratic advantage. But we've always seen, always, meaning in the last three or four midterms, a very different midterm electorate that could be just 1 point more Democratic or even 1 point more Republican looking at the last two midterms plus the recall election. So that suggested a two electorates kind of model for the state is pretty well supported by most of the exit poll data going back a good ways. So to see an electorate that at least as of now in the exit polls looks like it was just plus one Democrat instead of plus five or six suggests a shift. Now, maybe it is just a one-time turnout advantage for Republicans or disadvantage for Democrats, more likely. So I don't want to read too much into it, but we get asked this question all the time. Is Wisconsin still a blue state? And I think you'd have to look at those numbers and say in midterms, we haven't been a blue state for a while. We've been at best a competitive state. But now, if the presidential number shifts like this, Democrats can't count on high turnout in presidential years any more than they've been able to count on high turnout in midterms. And that's a real challenge to the party.
The potential takeaway is Wisconsin is no longer a solid Democratic for the presidential. Yeah.
If this holds up, 2020 will be the test, of course. What happens then?
And then the second biggest change, no surprise, but some of your numbers are very interesting. We have a decline in public and private unions. So can you elaborate?
Sure. The drop is now overall to union membership below 10%. Union households is a bit bigger than that, but coming down a bit over the last 4 years, about 4 or 5 points, I think.
Yes.
Depending on which kind of union you're looking at, and households rather than individual members includes everybody in the household. But when you look at that, you see that households are often divided. Spouses of union members are not that much more loyal to the Democratic candidate than just the average voter. So in the household, there's some division. And we've seen roughly a third of union members voting Republican in recent elections. So you've got a shrinking group that is less unified in its partisan support. And, of course, it ramifies on the public union side where those unions are just shadows of what they were
before Act 10.
And that has changed the electoral politics and the interest group politics of the state considerably.
Another major change is Republican control of our Capitol. Now, as you pointed out, from 2011 through now, 2018, we have not seen this in Wisconsin political history?
Our history, at least since the 90s and even back into the 80s, has been one of more divided government rather than unified party control. I looked at it just from the 1994 election, the 95 legislative session, to the present. And between 95 and 2010, there were only two-year periods of unified government where the same party controlled both houses and the governorship.
Only two.
Only two. And now we've had four in a row. That's quite a shift, I think.
Do your polls tell you whether it's a case of the Republicans playing better offense with a message than the Democrats? What do the numbers suggest?
It's hard to know the details of message, but in terms of candidates who have laid out a set of policies that they're coherently running on, if you will, I think Republicans have had an advantage. Now, part of that advantage comes from being in unified control. Your party is clearly responsible for everything from Act 10 through right to work to the present. If you're a Republican candidate, you mostly have to run on that record and defend it. If you're a Democratic candidate, you have to pick which parts of it to snipe at, which parts of it not to talk about, and lay out your own platform. That's not a Democratic problem as much as it is the minority party that runs into that problem. But the other thing that's striking in those data is Republicans have been gaining seats in the Assembly since 95 when they held 52. They were up to 60 seats before the 06 and 08 Democratic wave elections, and then they bounced up to 60 again in 2010. And they've risen just a little bit from that. Redistricting may play a role in the stability right now, but they were already up to 60 seats before 06 and 08 and then rebounded in 2010 to that level. This is a longer-term advantage for Republicans that crosses two different redistrictings and then a third.
And there's so many different factors there. Sure, you talk about your districts, you talk about campaign cash, you talk about the type of the quality of candidates that are on the ballot, and you talk about momentum and things like that. Okay, the final big change, the Governor Walker's approval rating has slumped since 2014?
Pretty dramatically. In 2012 and 13, he had a net plus 4% job approval, more approval than disapproval. That slumped a little bit in 2014 to a bit over 1%, but then it just cratered down to about 18% more negative than positive, and has risen to about 13 or 14% in this last year, but still much more negative than he was in the first 3 years that we were doing the Marquette poll. And coming into a legislative session that you will certainly be talking about in the next few months, a budget that also is already meeting criticism within the legislature and division within the legislature. But he'll be coming into that not as strong in terms of public support. Maybe he will remake that public support. We have seen a bit of an upturn in the last few, but he's still net negative even in the last few polls.
Well, but do you think the single biggest factor in Governor Walker's slump in public approval is your, you know, I go deep in your numbers sometimes, the number of Wisconsin respondents who told you that they really didn't want him to run for president?
Yeah, that's certainly played a role. Now, it doesn't matter much among Democrats because they have a very low opinion of the governor to begin with. But it was striking that among Republicans, his biggest loss was among those Republicans that didn't want him to run. But they weren't a trivial part of the party. They were 34% of the party as of September, just as he dropped out of
34%.
The race. 34%. 34%. One in three Republicans didn't want him to run. And their approval rating of him had dropped by 28 percentage points.
Wow.
The biggest single drop of any partisan group. Now, his budget in January or February of 2015 didn't help because that also opened these divisions and made him a target for criticism within his party.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the double whammy of the presidential race and the difficult budget and criticism from within the party. The question is, this year there won't be the presidential race, but there certainly look to be divisions within the GOP.
Okay, we have about a minute left, and you know how I like to end my interviews with you. I want you to look forward. The major political or public policy decisions that people like you are going to be analyzing, scrutinizing closely for the next window.
I think clearly here in the state, the first step is that budget, because this will be the budget the governor runs for re-election on, assuming that he does run for re-election. And how that plays out within the legislature with some difficult areas, not just transportation, but Medicaid. As well. On the national side, Republicans have been waiting for 8 years to gain control and the chance to do things. And the question is, will they in fact push through a very large sweeping set of changes not unlike the way Democrats did when they had unified control in 2009 and 2010. Or will Republicans discover that they're not as unified about what to change to from things that they clearly don't like Obamacare, but already we're seeing difficulties of them deciding what to do. So I think that's just going to be fascinating to watch. And still, the question of what role does President Trump play in that?
Yeah.
Does he become a policy leader on big policy changes, or does he prefer a role of much broader speech making and leave it to the members of Congress to work out the details?
Plenty of things for professional policy watchers and pollsters like you over the next 2 years to follow.
We never lack for a supply of topics.
Although
to
you
talk
sound
about.
Like you may be doing things a little bit differently in 2018 in the next cycle.
There's no question we will look at what we could do better on the polling side, and that may include polling closer to Election Day. The real reason I haven't done that is I like releasing the week before to give the parties a chance to respond to whatever that news is.
Right.
In Iowa, there's a tradition of releasing only on Sunday morning in the Des Moines Register.
Yes.
And I don't like that. On the other hand, I don't like missing a change that happens late in the campaign. So we'll see.
Fascinating. Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll and a professor at Marquette. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.